Welcome to Medical Educate Talks. Welcome to our podcast, Medical Educate Talks, where members from the Developing Medical Educators team at the Academy of Medical Educators discuss topics of interest with experienced colleagues from their field. In today's episode, we're in conversation with Professor Sonia Kumar talking about social accountability in medical education.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to a new episode of Medical Educate Talks. My name is LJ, and today I'm ecstatic to be joined by Professor Sonia Kumar. Professor Sonia Kumar studied medicine at King's College London and went on to work as a GP in London. She was heavily involved in postgraduate education in London before joining Imperial College's Department of Primary Care and Public Health in 2013. During her time at Imperial, she led a growing and successful team as Director of Undergraduate Primary Care Education. She and her team won multiple awards for innovative teaching and educational research, including the Imperial College President's Medal for her outstanding contributions and the Advanced HC Kate Excellence in Education Award. She also founded the Medical Education Innovation and Research Centre, which focuses on the wider societal impact of medical training. Last year, Professor Kumar joined the University of Leeds as Associate Dean for Community Engaged Learning and remains a visiting professor at Imperial College. Now, that felt like such a whistle-stop tour of what has been, so far, a glittering career. But I wonder if I can kick off by asking you, Sonia, about where it all began and how you got started in medical education.
Thank you, LJ. So lovely for everyone who's joined us to listen to this. So for me, I think people and patients are making a difference. I mean, it sounds slightly, you know, corny, cringeworthy, but really that's where it began for me. And I remember sort of around the age, probably maybe sort of it was the same for many of us, 14, 15, just really thinking that actually I need to make this my career. I need to do something where I am actively making a difference. And because I love science, medicine seemed like a sort of an obvious option. When I left medical school and I joined being a house officer, and again, maybe this will resonate with some of your viewers, during medical school and even during my house jobs, I really struggled to find my place in a way, and to I had to almost convince myself to run the course, because the medicine that I was seeing and the medicine that was being practiced didn't necessarily connect with my values of wanting to understand people, patients and their journeys, and really what mattered to them. And as Michael Marmot says, the causes of the causes, you know, we were just seeing the tail end of stuff, you know, breathlessness, people coming in with cancers. But there were things that were lying behind those, and socioeconomic inequalities that were lying behind those. But you never really got your hands on those or really had time to uncover those. And so when I finished my house jobs, general practice felt like a really nice generalist spread for me to really just sort of think, well, OK, let's see how this goes. But I never put myself under pressure. I always thought, well, if it doesn't really work out, I'll do something else. I never really had a plan B, but I just thought I could do something else. And then through GP training, really, my sort of burgeoning interest in teaching really arose. And the two are so connected, aren't they? The sort of making a difference, communication. Yeah, I think they feel so aligned, teaching and general practice. And that's why it's of no surprise that many GPs are very good teachers and go into teaching careers as well. And so in terms of my academic career, that really landed when I think doing my master's, that was probably where doors really started to open. And again, you know, I'm really not someone who has had a giant mind map of their life. And, you know, from the age of 12 has mapped out, by this age, I'm going to do that. It's all been really sort of, what's the name of that novel? Snickets, is it? A series of unfortunate events. It sort of feels like it's been a series of fortunate events, but none of it's all been rather serendipitous and accidental. And so I did my master's. And again, that wasn't through sheer planning. That was because I had a chat to a friend who was doing a master's. It was a master's in primary care. It was at King's. That's where I did a lot of my training. And so I thought, well, actually, this seems like a good idea. I love learning. It's had the breadth. It really wasn't just focused on one area. It had learning and teaching. It had social science, health psychology, ethics, research design. It was really a really nice broad-based degree. So I did that, and that's really where doors started flying open, because probably this is now going back a few years, about 20 years when I got my master's, not that many people had master's degrees. And I know it's far more common now to have master's, which is great. And so then I became a program director at King's, so very much still rooting my feet in South London. And I did that probably for about 9 years alongside doing lots of other things. So, you know, in terms of, you know, things that I would recommend, I just put my hand up for everything. I did the recruitment panel. So you might remember, you know, when you have to go into GP training, you go through the selection centres. ARCP panels, where people have maybe had a bit of a rocky ride with getting through their various exams and progression points. I was also the quality and innovation program director lead for London, which really then started to open my eyes into sort of the broader stuff around general practice training. And then after about 9 or 10 years, I joined Imperial. And it was a bit of an unusual jump. Yes, I was director of primary care, but before that, I joined on a 6-month contract as a senior teaching fellow. So a very random jump from a long term career at London Deanery. But again, the London Deanery was going through huge shifts at the time, and it just felt like I needed a change. And this felt intuitively for me like the right change. And I went from postgraduate to undergraduate. And then while I was senior teaching fellow, I then applied to become director of primary care. And you summarised it beautifully. You know, 10 years I led the team, and it was a ball. It was an absolute ball. We had a lot of fun. I think one of my managers, who you'll remember, Jenna, she used to say, "We whistle while we work." And that's really how that's really how we work together. And, you know, you said we won multiple awards. Well, I think as I was leaving, we counted the number of awards. And in 5 years, we won 19 awards, which I think, you know, is some of them were internal, some of them were external. And really clearly, one of those was mine, but the 18 were for the team. And it was, you know, for me, as I'm leaving, that feels like, you know, that's the gold dust, that the team was winning awards. And I think they've, you know, still in contact with all of them, they've that sort of gold dust and nectar has carried on as a really thriving unit that was built around purpose. I think that's what the model of success was. We were built around shared purpose. It wasn't about individual gain. Yes, there were awards, but that wasn't why we were doing it.
Amazing. So I met you about 5 or 6 years ago as a medical student.
I think it might have been longer than that, but okay.
Well, I'm trying my best. I think it's 5 or 6 years ago, when I was still a medical student either way. And I've met the team you've spoken about, and I'm now lucky enough to work alongside some of them in my current role in education. Inspirational round. And I know that at the time when I met you, you were introducing sort of community engagement in general practice placements. I think it was for third years in their GP placements, they did a community action project. And that was my first introduction to even the concept of social accountability in medical education. And given that sort of the interest that I've led, I'm trying to lead this podcast with, I wonder if you could speak a little bit about what social accountability and civic responsibility is in education.
So I suppose if you want to be a purist, you'd go to the, let's think, 1995 WHO definition, which is where medical schools, I try and remember it, have an obligation to direct their education, research and service activities towards the people and communities they have a mandate to serve. Now, that may be roughly, I think, you know, what it says. And essentially it is that medical education needs to be bottom up. So the interests of the curriculum and the assessment aren't driven by the professors and the faculties and those sort of in leadership positions. It is driven by people. And as much as that sounds so intuitive, doesn't it? Well, why wouldn't it be? It does. That isn't what happens. And over years and years and years, universities have become increasingly disconnected with what people and local priorities are. And so that's really, you introduced it at the beginning. That was the beginnings of the Medic Triangle. And the Medic Triangle, which you summarise, is essentially at the centre is community engagement, and around it, the three pillars, education, community priorities, and then you've got workforce, which of course, if you get the right workforce, you're then serving that, you're serving your community to the best you can. And so really for me, social accountability is where you start. You start with community priorities, and whether that's community engaged education, and we'll come on to that in a bit because my role now isn't just medical education, or whether it's community engaged research, it's where your starting point is. It's not top down, it's bottom up. And it's quite hard to do, actually. You know, if you think of all the changes happening in NHS England and Health Education England, and then internally a lot of universities undergo a lot of changes, what essentially we're having to do is actually join dots, which again, intuitively, you think, well, why wouldn't you join the dots? But it's quite hard if you want to look at the priorities of, well, what's the local NHS saying? What are they saying about the five top priorities? What are your local city council saying are their top priorities? What's Public Health England in your local area, your local public health directorate? What are they saying? And then using those to direct a medical school curriculum, you'd have probably the outcome of your curriculum would look quite different to doing it top down.
Absolutely. And do you think that that extends into postgraduate training as well as undergraduate training?
Of course, of course. And even not just the content of the training and where the priorities, but how the training is delivered. Because the other key aspect of community engagement isn't just where the priorities come from, bottom up, not top down. There's two other really important things here. That's one of them isn't around asset based development. And so the sort of line that's often used is what is strong, not what is wrong. And so the way in which you look at priorities is you don't look at them through the lens of a deficit model. You look at them, well, what's strong in an area? So it may well be that child dental health, you know, under fives dental health is a real issue in a particular area, as I know it is in the north of England, which is where I now work. But looking at it, what already a community is doing to try and improve the health of, you know, and it could be that there are workshops that schools are trying to do stuff. Well, your role then is to add on to build on what's already happening, not to take away or to say, actually, we're going to do something completely different. And so asset based, bottom up priorities. And the last bit is reciprocity and co-creation. And that's really important, but again, really hard to do. So if you have identified an area such as childhood dental health, you don't then go off and say, right, we're going to send our medical, our dental students, it would be, out into an area to deal with, you know, the under fives. You would work with the community and say, well, actually, what's going to make a difference to you? And it might be, yes, it might be dental access, but equally it might be, actually, the real issues at schools and in nurseries, that's really where we need a bit of health literacy and support with parents and their children. So if you don't co-create, the problem is your community engagement, as much as it may come from a place of goodwill, you completely misfire, because what you create isn't fit for purpose, because communities have said, well, thanks for asking, but you've gone off and done your own thing, which isn't really what we wanted. And so if you do co-create, then comes reciprocity, because students will learn through service and communities will gain, but they'll only gain if you create something that they wanted in the first place.
So you've spoken quite a lot about some of the challenges there, and I've picked up a few challenges insofar that the university has to look outwards a lot more than just its department or maybe the department next door. It has to actually go out into the world that it occupies. And especially in healthcare education, you've got your patients in the population and how that all interacts as well to think about. So in medical education, there's lots of patient participation, patient involvement in developing resources or perhaps being the resource and things like that. And there's third sector organisations, so charities and things that you can get involved with. There's so much. It's that almost overwhelming and intimidating. You can feel, oh gosh, where do I start with it all?
I mean, I suppose it depends at what level you are. So if you are working as a faculty lead, you know, you're a department head or a faculty lead, or you've got a leadership position at the medical school, then I think because you'll have backup and you'll have resource, then I think that kind of external scoping exercise becomes an easier thing in a way, because you'll have maybe administrative and management support, because this isn't an easy task. As you said, there's the publicly available data, and then there's the kind of softer but very hard data, which is what a community group saying that they need. Because, of course, we know that the NHS, again, it's which patients are going to be coming forwards to inform their PPI kind of strategy. But if you're a module lead and you're just sort of starting out and you're sort of tasked with develop this module and you think I'd really like it to be community engaged, I guess what you're asking is, yes, how not to be overwhelmed. Well, there are public sources of information that you can go to. So Public Health England has got various resources. I think it's called the Fingertips Resources. There's OHID, which is the Office for Health Inequalities and Disparities. You know, there are various publicly available bits of information. And actually, when we were developing the Community Action Project, the Community Collaboration Lead at the time, which I'm not sure you met, Bethany Golding, that actually what she created alongside the Community Action Project were NABAs, which actually we would change now to PABAs, and I'll explain why. So a NABA was a need and asset based assessment. And this is where, with medical students, actually, she created these lovely maps so that actually when students were doing their community action projects, at a glance, they could look at what are the needs, what are the priorities, and what are the assets. And so because of the assets, really, I think over time, my language has shifted. And I think for all of us, this is a learning journey. I would no longer use the word needs, it's priorities, because it's essentially, as soon as you start using the word, what do communities need, you are labelling them as sort of being in deficit. There is something missing. There's a gap that needs filling. And there's only one way to fill it, and that's for an external agency to come in and fill the gap. And so priorities are often shared priorities. You know, there could be a priority for the community and a priority for the university that you can align. But I think in terms of where to start, identifying priorities is probably a really good way to start. And then the other place, which is probably a good leadership, little memento anyway, which is network, network, network. Your networks are where you get your intel from. Twitter, it is an amazing networking place, you know, if used in the right way. Amazing places, amazing place for you to get a lot of information, also connect with people. There are a lot of people who are trying to do this already. And I think community engagement in medical education is a really, it's quite a kind of hot topic at the moment. A lot of people are doing it. So learn from others.
And on that note, I wonder if we could sort of meander a bit towards your current role. So you don't just do medical education, you do community engaged learning across a spectrum.
I suppose when I first joined Leeds, I thought, well, OK, I'll go from medical education to health professions education. You know, that feels, you know, nursing, midwifery, PAs, cardiac physiologists, you know, that feels comfortable. And then over time, you know, the community engaged learning sort of expanded, and then it sort of was community engaged learning across the faculty. So engineering, business, arts and humanities. And then over time, it's not even a great amount of time, I've been there 8 or 9 months. The role now has sort of expanded to setting up the centre, and that was always going to happen, wasn't it? I was going to set something up. I didn't think it was on the cards, but there we are. But the cool thing about the centre is it's a centre without a centre. So it's a community engagement network in research, education and civic engagement. So two E's at the end. But it's not a centre. So it's a leadership model really based on distributive leadership and transformative leadership. So leading through others and leading through a distributed network. I am not the lead of the centre. I'm the sponsor of the centre. I am there to act as a conduit between the little group, the community of practice and senior leadership. But the centre, in a way, owns itself and has the expertise and the knowledge. I suppose it's about using the centre and the University of Leeds as a really as a hotbed of civic activity. There is so much civic activity going across the university, and really the idea of the centre is about bringing it together, about building on each other's strengths. So again, those asset-based approaches that I spoke about that you can use with communities, that we need to use with communities, you can use internally as well. And the idea of co-creation that we talked about using with communities, you can use that internally. You co-create together, co-create with your students, co-create with communities. And so what we produce, we can build on each other, collaborate with each other, showcase what we're doing, and make it even better, really. So as I said, the role's expanded now. So it's education, research, all civic activities, really, and how that group of experts can lead the centre forwards.
Wow. Well, I had no idea about the centre. This is very exciting. I suppose that the obvious question then is what can be learned from non-MedEd to bring into MedEd? So have you got any examples of perhaps other disciplines or faculties doing things or in entirely different areas doing things differently and what we can learn from that?
So it's difficult if you're in an institution that is very STEM-based. But if you are able to collaborate with those outside of STEM, it is hugely beneficial because in some ways it stretches and challenges you and blows your mind. And we talk about threshold concepts, don't we? But it completely challenges your thinking because those who come from a different discipline, such as the arts and humanities, their understanding of power and social justice is very different and probably slightly more progressed than I would say some of us, including me. I've learned a lot just in the 9 months that I've been at Leeds. And actually working with others outside of your comfort zone, particularly from a different discipline, is really enriching. And, you know, you can see these kind of interesting and sometimes taught conversations, which are so kind of, you know, with the right people, are brilliant because you're informing their thinking and they're definitely informing your thinking of actually, because what underlines a lot of community engagement is actually power. That's, you know, that is essentially what we're talking about. We're talking about redressing power and giving up power back to communities. I mean, a lovely example is I was reading a paper, and again, it was from the social sciences, about how some communities have set up their own community panels. So you know how all universities have a research ethics and the research ethics committee decides whether or not something is ethical and whether or not communities will be harmed or patients will be harmed. Well, actually, some communities have actually said, well, actually, I think the best people to decide whether or not we are going to be harmed and whether your research question meets our needs is us. And so they've set up their own community panel. So before you conduct research or you want to do a new innovation, the community panel, which chairs itself, will decide whether or not your project is viable and you're allowed to take it forward. Brilliant, brilliant. But essentially, that's all about redressing power, isn't it? And it's about giving back power that. You know, there are so many things here, aren't there, sort of, you know, that have colonial nuances, aren't they, about who holds the power and about giving back power. But power needs to exist in society, doesn't it? Otherwise, we end up in the state that we're in, which is disparities, inequalities and unhappiness. But the other bit, so, you know, looking outside of MedEd, I would also urge people, and again, I think this probably links to what I said about sort of decolonizing our thinking, is looking completely outside of the literature. And so, you know, things like Ikigaya from the Japanese philosophy around purpose and what brings people together. Ubuntu from South Africa, which is about I am because we are, and that's about connection. You know, there's a lot we can learn that go way beyond, you know, the academic space and way beyond. You know, I've talked about other disciplines, but this is going way beyond, you know, to a different sphere where, you know, again, I think there's a lot of two-way enriching conversations to be had. And again, because MedEd and many other academic disciplines are quite traditional, that these aren't places that we would normally go to for learning. But yet I do think there's a lot of learning there.
Absolutely. And I think you speak really, really passionately about that, and that must come from something other than just pure academic enthusiasm, right? So there has to be something else there. So I'm really pleased that there is, because otherwise I was thinking, gosh, how on earth are any of us going to get to your level of creativity? And it's because there's creativity and there's looking beyond the boundaries of academia, which is really, really powerful to hear, I think. and being sort of early in my own career, like knowing that someone in your position, sort of associate dean and being in a quite a strong leadership position, knowing that you haven't been laughed out of the door when you bring these things to your colleagues and your bosses and things. It sounds like you're very well received everywhere you go. And why do you think that is?
I mean, I remember talking with someone quite senior about this, about ambition. And we were having a bit of a debate on, how it feels to be around people who are ambitious. And my conclusion was, and I remember saying this to them, that actually it's not about being ambitious or not ambitious. It's what you're ambitious for and whom. And I think if you're ambitious for yourself, that comes across pretty quickly, doesn't it? And no one really wants to be around ego-driven people who are really in it because they're trying to climb whatever ladder that they think is a ladder worth climbing. If you're ambitious for your ideas and your purpose and your vision, I think it's very easy to gather people and take them with you, because that's a bigger thing, isn't it? No one wants to follow a person, but people will follow a concept or an idea that deeply resonates with them. And we all have our stories, don't we? And you're right, the passion doesn't come from, you know, publishing papers or getting degrees. Of course it doesn't. It comes from somewhere a lot deeper. But there are other people with similar stories and very different stories. And if you resonate with those stories, then of course people will want to follow a purpose, because that's quite a deep thing, isn't it? So they're not following, you know, it's not about following me or following my ideas. It's a purpose. And that's, yeah, that you know, we read about this, don't we? Communities of practice. And as I mentioned, Ikigaya, and it can all sort of feel slightly two dimensional when you're reading about them, can't it? You know, a community of practice is a group of people that meet regularly and they share a passion or purpose for. Yeah, that all sounds great. But actually, when you live it and breathe it and you really are a purpose driven, values driven. And that's the other thing I really think I cannot emphasize enough. People don't want to be around people where they don't share their values. So I'm not saying that anyone's values are better than others. You just need to be around people and in a place where you share the values. And if you can get that, those sort of nuggets in place, shared values and purpose, probably anything's possible.
Exactly. And I know when I met you and your team about 5-6 years ago, you actually completely changed the trajectory of my career. And I think that was purpose-based and that was values-based. And I think that it sort of coming across you all and how much you all loved general practice and sort of this community-based learning and, you know, just fundamentally being a good doctor in that sort of space and sort of sharing that knowledge through education and being enthusiastic really sort of resonated with me. And I think that's why I am going on the track that I'm currently going on. So yes, it works, listeners. It works if you follow the values and follow the happiness. Anyway, as we sort of come towards the end, Sonia, I wonder if you could indulge me a little minute, and maybe give maybe look back to when you're at the beginning of your medical education career, academic career, and what piece of advice would you give yourself?
The word that comes to mind is fearless. But this is something that I probably feel I am fearless. And I think in academia, that's quite a hard thing to be, and in medicine. So, you know, you put them together and you get a group of people that really it's quite a hot chamber of stuff, isn't it? High achieving medics. And then in academia, you've got high achieving people. And yeah, you sort of, it's a double whammy, isn't it? So it's quite hard to be fearless, and you don't want to be reckless. So it's not being reckless, it's being fearless. And the advice I think I would have given myself, because I've always been fearless, and that obviously for another time has stories behind it. You should question it to ensure that you aren't being reckless. You're not hurting people. You're not treading on people. You're being ethical. And most importantly, going back to what we said, is if you can answer those questions, is this purpose driven or self driven? And is this, am I proud of myself? You know, are these true to my values? And other people who share my values, and possibly where your values come from, so there may be notable people, family, would they be proud of me as I'm sort of making these decisions? Then that sort of helps you when you're having to make decisions. And as sort of I gave you a sense of some of my decisions from the outside may have seemed slightly, fearless, you know. You know, the job moves that I've made, but because they came from a place of, purpose and values, that it's always just sort of in my mind made sense and I've landed on my feet.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. This conversation has meandered in so many different directions. We could have spoken about so much more. But I think and I hope that this short podcast has sort of provided lots of inspiring nuggets, as you called them, for our listeners, sort of as they start and move through their medical education career. So thank you so much for speaking with me, and perhaps catch up soon and we can talk about some of those other things offline maybe.
Thank you for listening.
So that's it for today's episode of Medical Educator Talks. We hope you've enjoyed it, and if you have, please give us a follow so you can find out when the next episode is released. If you'd like to find out more information about the Developing Medical Educators Group, visit medicaleducators.org, and we'll see you in the next episode.